Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight, 295 for comics originally released on April 3rd, 2013. Starting us off in DC, over in the Vertigo section, is Ferris number 14. Now, this is a done-in-one story by Bill Willingham and Barry Kitson, featuring Princess Alder. I probably mispronounced that. Alder?
I think it's just Alder.
We'll go with that. I'll be honest, Bob. When we looked at the solicits for this, for some reason, I was just erroneously thinking it was the little tiny fairy girl that hangs out with the monkey.
I forget what her name is.
But you know who I'm talking about, the blonde
pixie-sized
one. But this was a really fun done-in-one story. I mean, they shine the spotlight on some characters that really don't get it that often. Renard the Fox, obviously the princess. Peter Piper and Bo Peep were strong supporting characters here. It very much was a self-contained, if this is the first issue of any of the Ferris or Fable stuff that you've read, I think it's very understandable, provided you kind of already know the premise of Fables. And what I liked is, while it was pretty much a done-in-one story, it plants the seed for a future story that I frankly would expect we would get in this title in maybe a year's time.
Yeah, I mean, I thought this was, it was a great issue. It was also, so far, kind of an atypical issue for the Ferris title, because it was written by Bill Willingham, who writes the main Fables series that this is kind of a spin-off of. Whereas typically Ferris is written by other writers.
Mm-hmm.
Before Chris Roberson severed his ties with DC Vertigo, he would write the great Cinderella stories on in this series, and you know, I don't think we're going to be getting any more of those, at least not from him. But you know, the last series in this title, I had a little trouble with, and I think
the Rapunzel one.
The Rapunzel one.
Isn't it ironic that one, which I think we both agree was incredibly decompressed and just went too long, is followed by a done-in-one story?
Yeah, and that one was just challenging also because of the storytelling style, and I think maybe some of the Japanese mythology, which I'm not as familiar with, or at least the way it was presented. Whereas this one, even though I wasn't particularly familiar with most of the characters in it, it just seemed to flow. You know, it's just, I didn't feel like I didn't know what was going on. And it's like, I don't recall Princess Alder in this particular state being featured much. And I mean, Reynard the Fox has been around, but you know, a lot of the characters, it just flowed really nicely. And this is kind of the hallmark of the Fable series too. And it just has, my way of thinking, just a lot to do with Bill Willingham and why he's such a great writer. Because he can just take these things and write, and he tells such an elegant story. You
well,
know,
I think
it just flows.
Part of it with this one, and I think why you felt that way about this issue versus, say, the Rapunzel one, is the Rapunzel one was going off of building off past events, both seen and unseen. Here, everything is that you need is literally in the story. It's not really steeped in the history of these characters. You don't have to know that much about them, what they've done before, to enjoy and understand this story. So there's a certain built-in accessibility to this that I think the Rapunzel story lacked. And I agree with you entirely that Bill Willingham is just a really great writer. And even when Fables has, you know, six-issue story arcs or whatever, which it usually does, frequently does, even middle chapters of that are very accessible. Have enough stuff happen in it to have a satisfying amount of story chunk, progress, and rarely do I ever read one of those issues. I don't know that I've ever read an issue of Fables where I think, wow, I'm just lost. I need to go reread something to understand what's going on here.
Right.
Whereas in many other titles, matter of fact, I think I mentioned that a week or two back about Morning Glories, where it's like, wow, a ton happened there, but I didn't really appreciate it all because, again, I didn't remember everything. And, again, this is the perfect example of a clean, done-in-one story that builds on characters that have been established before to varying degrees, in, out with a great story story to tell and satisfying conclusion, yet not a the end, there will never be anything else about this ever again, kind of, which gives the sense of filler issue if they were to have done that. The one thing I wasn't crazy about in this issue, and it's just a story technique that rarely works for me, is the breaking of the fourth wall that happened a few times in this story.
Yeah, with Reynard.
Yeah. It made sense for the story, it worked within the story, but that's just not a technique I'm a huge fan of. Flip side, I am a huge fan of Barry Kitson's art, and I think he did a fantastic job here, as did the colorist. Andrew Dahlhaus used like a wood grain texture for the princess's kind of skin tone. There were some subtleties and shadings in, you know, Reynard's fox coat and stuff like that, that I think this would be a very interesting issue to see the pencils versus the inks versus the colored pages, because I think you would see certain things, certainly between, say, the inks and the colored pages.
Yeah, that's often a lot of times when they put kind of sketchbook pages in the back of a book where they kind of show the progression on a page. Mm-hmm. That's always really interesting to see, you know, when it goes through the various phases of production and they're adding different layers to the book. Just kind of seeing what each one of the contributors to the art is actually contributing to the finished product. And you can kind of see as it, you know, you have the pencils, then you have, in some cases, you know, especially lately, they are using so much computer stuff. A lot of times they don't do inks as such. You know, a lot of times they'll do pencils, and then they scan that in and do stuff in the computer to it. I'm not sure when you have Barry Kitson as the artist and there's no inker. I guess we have Inaki Miranda did finishes, which would be inks usually, on pages 10 through 16 and 18 through 19. So maybe those are in there. But it's just really fascinating to see how those get done, especially when you're seeing the colors on a lot of these modern books. When you see the black and white art, you can really see the richness and quality that's being added by the color artist on these books. Much more so than in the past, I think. The colorist today is really adding as much of an element as the inker, and in some cases more. In some cases, they skip the inker altogether, and they just have the colorist do, you know, a lot of that adding texture and detail and all kinds of stuff to the original art.
It would be interesting, though, to have the original uncolored art, the colors minus the original art, kind of side by side, and then below that, the finished page. Because I think in some cases, it's possible, granted they obviously used the line art to figure out where to put the colors and stuff, but sometimes the colors themselves would be enough to tell the story, minus the line art, though granted I enjoy the combination. You know, it's very interesting, and again, this is one where I was particularly taken by the additional level of detail and care that I thought the colorist put in on this issue. Whereas in a lot of cases, yeah, the colors are there, but don't really stand out to me in a very, wow, they added a lot to this issue way. And it's an invisible art to a degree. You know, it's like what they say about a soundtrack. If you're hearing it, it's not doing its job.
I think this issue is almost a great done-in-one commercial for the main Fable series.
Yes, I would, you know, totally agree with that.
Someone could just come in, pick up this series, and I mean, pick up this issue, and if you like this issue, you're going to like Fables. If you read this issue and say, wow, it's not my cup of tea, that probably means that Fables is not your cup of tea either, which is, you know, fine. It's good to know that. But I thought it was a great issue. It's a high 4 out of 5 for me.
That's exactly what I give it to. I thought it was really well done. And like you said, this is a good way for somebody to test the waters on the Fables universe if they would like to. And I think they should, because it's great stuff.
Next up, we've got Thanos Rising #1 from Marvel. Jason Aaron writing and Simone Bianchi on art. Now, this is an origin story, really, for Thanos. And I think we're going to be seeing Thanos coming into play a lot more in the Marvel Universe upcoming. He was in that teaser at the end of the Avengers movie, which means that, you know, he'll be a featured bad guy, I believe, in the next big screen Avengers movie. And we'll be seeing him a lot more around the Marvel Universe. Now, this issue, after a couple of pages at the front, we flash back to many years ago on Titan, and we get Thanos' birth and his youth. And I found it very interesting to see. You know, I don't think we've ever seen Thanos as a child before. Maybe we have.
I'm wondering if we did in the 12-issue Thanos series, maybe. I think we've seen him as maybe more of a teenager, maybe not quite this young, but I don't recall.
But, you know, more probably just, you know, like a scene or a panel or two, not anywhere near this in depth. So I enjoyed this issue. Kind of you're telling the story of Thanos, so it kind of makes sense that you don't get that much adult Thanos in this issue. And, you know, we're just seeing the very early phases of what's making the Thanos that we see today what he is. This whole thing with the lizards and stuff, that was kind of interesting. I never really think of all the extraneous wildlife and creatures on some of these planets that these guys are on.
Well, it's interesting because if you go to the page flip before the staple where we see young Thanos' sketchbook, he's sketching one of these lizardy things that's dead and decomposing, and he's sitting there out in the school playground area. So apparently on Titan, they don't really care if there's dead, decomposing, you know, animals around, which I found interesting. Like you said, this is very much the origin of Thanos. Much like the origin of the Red Skull they did a while back, this is a dark tale. And I was a little surprised by the personality they gave young Thanos. You know, smart kid, a little socially awkward, but, you know, almost, for lack of a better term, a little bit of a wimp. You know, he seemed to be just... And part of it is a very, I think, father that was very disassociated. And it's interesting here we also never see Star Fox, who, if he had had his powers at this point, and I don't know if he did or not, would have automatically been kind of the center of attention because his power is to make people like him, essentially. But they went with this kid could have turned out to have been one of the greatest heroes in the universe, because that's the way he was leaning, more or less, sketches of dead, decomposing lizards aside. But then, you know, I don't want to say he was turned evil or whatever, but, you know, once people started thinking the worst of him, he lived up to that. You know, it seemed like a very blatant he wasn't born evil writing ploy, even though the birth scene with his mother seems to directly contradict that. It's like they want to play nature nurture and not really make a clear decision on either direction. I felt the story was a little confused in that area and seemed to be going with what I thought could be obvious writing ploys. At this point, we'll see later if that's how it turns out. I was also, did they name the girl, the young girl who kind of befriends young Thanos?
I was looking for that, and I didn't notice them naming her. And I'm almost kind of looking at, she's always kind of off to the side. And, I mean, she does interact with the other kids, so it's not like she can be completely a figment of Thanos' imagination or anything like that. I was almost thinking that she would end up being the death character.
I was thinking that too.
But I find that a little hard. Maybe they're going to do something with that. But, I mean, she does interact with other characters in this story. So she's certainly one of the Eternals here on Titan. And that's that's kind of a after Thanos' introduction at some point, but probably, you know, has been around as long as most people who are reading comics today have been reading comics. That was kind of merged together, you know, the whole Eternal stuff and Thanos, where they kind of put the Eternals into that whole thing. I'm not really sure why, and maybe they'll play this up, but it seems like he's got some kind of deviant gene in him somewhere, looking the way he does, right?
Yeah, well, something caused it. They claim it's just a mutation. So I think they're setting Thanos up to join the X-Men.
There you go. Mutant.
That would be funny. I liked this issue, but I felt there should have been a little bit more, and I think the more I thought about it, it was the way it started off. Is it just me, or does it seem like a lot of the Marvel titles set in space are starting off the stories by essentially burning off a page with the vastness of space? We get that here. I think we got that in Nova. We might have also gotten that over in either Guardians of the Galaxy and or Iron Man, where it's, let's just do a backdrop of space so we can see that we're not on Earth, as if we couldn't figure that out. But we spend a good couple of pages before we get into Thanos's, you know, memory lane aspect. And granted, they did a few things in those couple of pages in the captions and whatnot. It was a slow start to the story and not particularly meaty content there. It was kind of just, you know, let's spend a few pages slowly setting up the framing sequence or what have you. It made me feel this issue should have had just a little bit more substance to it. I mean, did you feel that way, or was it just me?
I didn't really feel that way. I didn't feel unsatisfied when I got to the end of the story. You know, it's like a lot of times I'll get to the end of a story and I'll say, is that all there is? You know, and that in the back of my head, that's really the indication to me that I didn't get a satisfying chunk of story. You know, maybe not everything moved along as much as it could have, but I think it got to a good enough point, given that we're having a 6-issue kind of origin of Thanos story. So I felt I got enough story in this issue for my purposes. And I really liked the art in it. So hopefully, and I know Bianchi's not, I don't think he's the fastest artist in the world. So hopefully we've got several issues in the can at this point, so they'll be able to keep this one coming out on a regular basis. I think the next issue is supposed to be out, according to this, on May 1st. So that's only, what, like 3 weeks after this one came out? Or is it four?
Four. So it would be, you know, regular monthly comic and stuff. And that'd be good, because it would, this is, I think, the kind of story that would not benefit from huge delays between issues, because we're seeing basically the turn to the dark side kind of a storyline here. Again, much like we saw with the Red Skull when they did that, and I think we even saw that with Magneto a couple of years back. And it's one of those where, you know, turning to the dark side is not just flipping a light switch. So seeing that progression play out, if you've got awkward delays in the storytelling, that hurts it. So hopefully, like you said, they've got these in the can and will come out on a timely basis.
Mm-hmm. So, strong 4 out of 5 for me.
For me, it was a low 4 out of 5. I think they're doing some good stuff. I'm hoping we get a little more story content in future issues. I think this had a decent amount, but I couldn't help but feel that almost a fifth of it or whatever, the first couple of pages, could have been a little bit more revealing, more story points or something like that. Again, it wasn't like it was shy of it. I think they made a good transition from he's born, we see him as a young kid, and then we start to see that first turn to the dark side. So we got some definite character progression here, which I appreciated.
Good solid issue, though, and it was a good miniseries, I thought.
Yeah, we'll see where they go with it and where they leave the character, because we could see another 4 issues of the Memory Lane get back to where we see him at the beginning of this issue, with him resolved to go do whatever he's going to go do. You know, therefore launching him back into the Marvel Universe proper, if you will. So, we'll see.
And last up, we've got Harbinger Wars number 1 from Valiant. This is Valiant's first extra, the new Valiant's first miniseries, and it's a crossover, but it's not crossing over every single book in the Valiant Universe. So they're starting off a little slower, which I think is a wise choice. And here, this story primarily concerns the Harbinger and Bloodshot regular titles. And we're really getting to see the interplay between Peter Stanchek and his group and Toyo Harada and then the Project Rising Spirit on the other side, and well, how they're all interrelated to one another.
And in Bloodshot on the third side.
Yeah, like I guess Bloodshot's kind of related to the Project Rising Spirit, although he's a splinter off from them at this point.
Well, he certainly originated there, but I think we've got a three-way war going on here, which I think will be very interesting. There were a couple of things that kind of stood out in this issue for me. The scene with Peter, the Bleeding Monk, and Harada taking place in that dreamscape and stuff, that ties into a scene in next week's Harbinger number 11. Now, normally I wouldn't know that, but since we're going to record the next weekly spotlight later today, I've already read that and stuff. And what I like is it gives clear kind of touch points for where this kind of hooks into the Harbinger series. We kind of know where it hooks in to the Bloodshot series if you've been reading those titles. Yet, even if you haven't been reading those titles, I think this story worked well and was accessible and gave you what you need to understand the Harbinger War itself, even if you may not fully know and appreciate all the aspects that readers of Harbinger or Bloodshot would. So they did a really good job, I think, balancing, tying it in firmly and clearly with the two titles, yet also trying to make it something that could stand on its own and not force you to read the miniseries and both other titles. And that's a difficult act to pull off. I did find it interesting that we start with a page with kind of the meeting to discern the aftermath and I guess who's going to be the fall guy, maybe. And then we cut to the scene in China by a totally different art team. I mean, it was a noticeable difference in art, but not a jarring one, not too distracting, even when they flip back on facing pages to that scene in the closed room. It was interesting they chose or needed to have another artist do that one scene. It did help set it aside as, hey, this is a kind of a flashback from, you know, this sort of thing. In that team, we get to meet Christian, who's essentially the team leader of one of Harada's strike forces or whatever. And this issue did a great job setting that character up. He seems like a natural leader, and I'm kind of hoping he comes out of this miniseries leading a team of some sort in a new title. He would be one that would be fun to watch. This covered a lot of ground, I think really set up the different factions in the war, set up the stakes. It made sense as to why things are going to cross over, introduces a lot of characters in a way that's just a, hey, want you to know this character exists. We're not spotlighting him right now, but we're kind of fleshing out our universe and want to show that we've got more than just, you know, Bloodshot, the handful of Harbingers, and Harada in this game. So I thought they did a very good job on this. How about you?
No, I love this issue. I didn't mind. And I'm not exactly sure. I know that one flashback sequence is by Clayton Crane, and he's another, you know, not the swiftest artist in the world, so maybe by having him do a short little amount that they slide in, they can, you know, keep the series out on time. I know that Valiant has so far been very, very good about shipping books on time and keeping everything flowing. They've been doing a lot of things right behind the scenes as well as in front of the scenes. You know, they're doing stuff to just keep everything flowing, and then the stories that I'm seeing hit the stands. I've been really enjoying everything that they've been putting out. As all these characters, this had, you know, as one would expect, a lot of setup, but like in the Thanos story, even though it was set up, I felt like I got a lot of stuff happening in this issue. You know, I didn't come away from this saying, you know, is that all? I felt like I got a good amount of story here. And we moved along several parallel storylines, as you're talking about, and got some progression points and learned some interesting information about a lot of different characters here.
What I liked is they used some of the scenes very effectively to move along those different plot lines and reveal little aspects about certain characters. I loved the bit with Monica's kind of animated lion. And it's like, okay, what exactly is her power? How does that play out? Don't know, but it looks cool. There was also some good uses of Telic's powers, We get one scene with Isaiah and just kind of, you know, how that plays out. There are little character moments put in there to provide other character moments and to move the storylines along. And that kind of dual purpose or multi-purpose use of the scenes is part of why this felt very rich in terms of story, very dense in a good way, but not... this thing never felt, you know, overly crowded or chaotic or anything of the sort, and there are a lot of characters in here. Mm-hmm. They did a very good job balancing all of that.
Very, very well done.
And for me, strong 4 out of 5.
Same here.
So, what else have you had time to read for this week?
I have read pretty much everything that I got from this week. I was on a long car trip, so I caught up on everything. But as such, it's now kind of all flying around in my head.
I know that feeling very well. There were three things I wanted to talk about real quick. One, over in Batwing, it looks like a major event is set up in this issue to play out in the next issue. Pretty big deal for that title. Whether it's a big deal beyond that, don't know. I was frankly surprised by the kind of reveal at the end. And then, of course, we had Detective number 19, which, if they hadn't rebooted and renumbered, would have been Detective Comics number 900. I thought it had a good use of Man-Bat, not a bad anniversary issue at all.
I read that one. I liked it. I actually got that. My subscription copy came on that one relatively quickly. That's a big score. $7.99 book that I got for $1 on my subscription.
Cool. This was also the start of the WTF month at DC, and I really don't understand what they were thinking with this. The basic gimmick here is you've got a cover. It's essentially a gatefold cover, and you open it and flip out the cover, and you get the big reveal for the solicit, essentially. And a couple of the cover reveals actually were pretty intriguing and might have gotten, I think, some people to buy the issue that wouldn't have otherwise. So to bury that behind the cover fold doesn't make sense to me, particularly like the one on Suicide Squad. So I think this was a cry for help in terms of how do we solicit comics these days. I think there's a real struggle with that going on. And when I say that, I don't mean that in any kind of demeaning way to the marketing departments over at like DC or Marvel or anywhere else, because I think it's an increasingly difficult, almost to the point of damn near impossible, to successfully solicit comics these days. They're trying to do it in a few bullet points, which I think is a mistake, with a single cover image for a story that's going to usually cross over about 6 issues. So how do you differentiate those issues without spoiling the story already in progress? It's a definite conundrum. But again, there are a couple of things that happened in these issues that, had it been teased better, and in some cases maybe it could have been, maybe it couldn't have been, they might have gotten some more sales on some of this. I don't know.
Yeah, because I didn't buy the Batwing or the Suicide Squad ones that you're talking about, and had there been some cool piece of information in the solicit. And the other thing is, I went to the comic shop, and you only see the front part of the comic, and unless everybody's going to be, and maybe, you know, unless you like pick up every single, and I did, I actually picked up a bunch of DC comics and flipped open the cover to look at them. You know, this is a nightmare for the people who are really, really hardcore on grading of comics, because every single one of these books is going to be just fondled all over the place in the comic book shops. You know, people flipping open those covers and such. But, you know, it just, I looked at them and I was like, ah, okay. Most of them I put back. That was the verdict.
For me, the ones, there were only a handful that was like, wow, okay, this should have been a part of the solicit somehow. Most of them were, yeah, okay. So I mean, I don't disagree with you on that as much.
On Detective 900, I mean, with the Man-Bats and stuff, I mean, you flip open the cover and you see all the Man-Bats. And it's like, well, I mean, it's cool having the extra, you know, cover piece, but, you know, just having Batman and all the Man-Bats just on the regular cover, I think would have probably been more effective. Instead of just getting the cover that we get that's on the rack, that's just this big Batman image, which I didn't really care for the coloring that much on. It was too much reds Red Orange. You know, if we would have gotten Batman versus just a whole bunch of Man-Bats, that makes it now not look like just the standard Batman poster image or superhero poster image that we see on so many covers. And now I see, wow, that's pretty cool. That caught my eye. I see Batman fighting this big horde of Man-Bats. Maybe I'm going to pick that comic book up and read it. Whereas unless somebody actually picked the book up from the Batman cover image and opened it, they don't see that.
Well, and why not put something on the cover to indicate this would have been the 900th, this is the 900th issue of Detective Comics? Otherwise, people are going to see, wow, it's an $8 thing for what's probably just another part or conclusion of an ongoing story arc that I know nothing about, which is an erroneous assumption. So I'm going to be very curious to see, and will not, it'll be a month before we get this data, to see how or if this really impacts sales at all for DC. So once the April numbers are out in a month, are we going to see an uptick of any sort like we did with the Zero month, or is it just going to be kind of business as usual, which is more what I'm expecting? So I think it was a let's try something, and I appreciate that, but I don't think it was effective, but we'll see.
I appreciate the fact that the WTF thing only existed in the previews catalog and didn't actually make its way through onto the comic book covers.
Yes. Although I question if, because there was no indication that there was the more of the cover on the gatefold, if some people go to the shop don't even notice that part.
That's true. I mean, it's not really obvious if you're just looking at the comic on the rack that there is more to the image.
So, I mean, I am not pushing that they should have put the WTF on the cover. I think that would have been a huge mistake, but...
A little blurb that just says, open cover for more or something. I don't know.
Some arrow saying, and find out, you know, flip to reveal. I don't know. I think it was a slightly confused cover gimmick. Whether it worked out or not, we'll know in about a month.
Yep.
Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think it does it for me and this group of books.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Batman, Little Gotham number 1 from DC, Fantastic Four number 6 from Marvel, and Invincible Universe number 1 from Image Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.